Hello and welcome to Archiving Queer Erasure in South Africa, a podcast from Container Magazine. This podcast is hosted by myself, Cassandra Roxburgh. I use fey-fair pronouns, and it is in conversation with Kev O'Hari, the executive director of the Gala Queer Archive in South Africa. Kev uses he-him pronouns. The conversation covers a myriad of topics as it relates to the collection practices of the Gala Queer Archive in South Africa, particularly with regards to the challenges they've been experiencing in digitizing the archive, and in the very particular need for queer representation in South African media and how the archive can assist in representing queer stories in South Africa.
So my name is Kev O'Hari. My pronouns are he and him, and I'm the executive director of the Gala Queer Archive. The Gala Queer Archive is a queer archive that's based in Johannesburg, South Africa. We're based at Wits University, and the archive was kind of created on the premise of speaking against this narrative or this trope of homosexuality being un-African. And the way in which we do that is by really uncovering the stories, lived experiences and histories of queer life in South Africa, but more and more considering kind of Southern Africa and the continent at large. Gala as an archive really does challenge the traditional notions of what an archive is. One, because our objective is to kind of reinsert and reimagine kind of voices within history, particularly because the project of archives has often been to silence or remove or really, you know, use archives as a powerful tool in subjugation. The queer archive is really turning that on its head. But we also recognize that a part of creating a visibility, which we think is an intrinsic role of an archive, is by also focusing on creating an archive that is living and breathing. And so we like to consider ourselves to be a contemporary community-based archive as well, which means that we engage in various forms of like community engagement, whether that's exhibitions, publishing books, doing podcasts, and really about creating a space of affirmation and visibility for our community, which I think is also particularly important in the African context, because the role of the archive is also to speak against counter the narrative, which I think is particularly the perception from the West of Africa being this place that is dark and where our community primarily suffers. And I think the objective of the archive is to say that in every corner of this continent, despite the laws, despite awful governments and violent governments and violent individuals, there are queer people living lives of remarkable joy and beauty and grace and community and resilience. And we feel that that's also a role of the archive.
Speaking of the living and breathing aspect of the archive, how do you go about finding the information, the collecting documents and stories to be archived? What are the primary collection practices that Gala tends to use?
You know, that's a very interesting question. There have been various ways in which we've done this in the past. I think our first and foremost, the first two questions that we ask ourselves is like, is this happening on the continent? And is it queer? And then how do we go about ensuring that there's a visibility for this? And the various ways in which we do that. One, we have oral history projects as a kind of mechanism and tool of engaging with communities, individuals, et cetera, and creating these collections. But I think, and that's just more practical, but I think, kind of broader picture, the role of the archive, we feel, is quite important in engaging with communities, with activists, and with activist organizations that are on the ground kind of pushing for change. So we often like to refer to Gala as a soft activist, wielding the kind of soft cultural ways of pushing boundaries, because we're not necessarily, you know, in the front picket lines or taking governments to court, for example. But our engagements with those individuals that are doing that, our engagements with community centers and various institutions, whether it's religious, whether it's academic, is quite important in understanding or getting a pulse of what's actually happening on the ground.
Yeah, whenever you see historians talk about their role in preserving knowledge, particularly once they take an activist role, there's this retrospective look back that you do at a lot of civil rights activists who also served as archives, where actually their function as historians, as people preserving the knowledge, starts to actually form this conversation going forward of how you can actually progress and where to come from. So while being soft activists, you still have this role to play in preserving the knowledge and pointing back to, and in many ways, actually countering the narrative of queerness being this Western import rather than something that always existed on the African continent.
Yeah, exactly that. And I think particularly in the kind of world that we now exist, where it's so easy to falsify or deem illegitimate kind of history and existence, that our role becomes even more important. So that when governments say to you, oh, but that homosexuality is a Western influence and there are no gays in our country, we're like, no, we know this because we are speaking to people. And then being able to do that in a way that is sensitive and sensitized, so that we're at the same time protecting the individuals that really are putting their lives at risk by their very existence.
I must imagine there must be a constraint that gets played with geography when trying to uncover queer history, particularly if you're trying to uncover history of queer identity within rural communities, just something that you don't see covered a lot in any mainstream coverage of queerness in South Africa, in Africa in general, actually. Let's not just focus it to South Africa.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where we as an archive also have to be quite reflective and self-critical. So for example, the majority of the collections in the archive are in English, and that's a problem as an African archive. One, because there's a strong oral history of passing on stories within traditional African culture. And I think as a queer archive, it's how do we engage with that? I think it's also important for us to say that, recording has to be done in a language that people feel comfortable with. And then that also means challenging the alphabet identity, LGBTQIA+, because what does that then mean in certain rural spaces? And I think there it's both important for us as an archive to be self-critical, but that's also what's really exciting about it, because it allows us to really broaden our reach to say a few years back we published this book called Meanwhile, which was a graphic novel. And it was done by the Kintu Collab. So it was young people from Southern and East Africa. And the way in which Kintu, the comic itself is archival, but it also allowed us to engage with communities to say there are different ways of telling one's story. A graphic novel or comic is really an important and engaging one, because it allows us to have this conversation over and above language, and so I think we're constantly trying to look at ways in which we have to be more sensitive to what it means to be an African archive, and language is one part of that. There's also issues around how do we engage with on the ground activists. One way it is still quite dangerous to do that, and then first and foremost has to be how do we protect those who are willing to share their stories,
And I almost wonder, to what extent does the project of the digitalization of archives, especially Goddess Archives, understand there is a project underway to digitize parts of it, what role that actually plays in making queer history more accessible and allowing for unique ways to approach the telling of stories? For instance, hypothetically, a webcomic where you can anonymize everyone's name in it, but still tell the story of particular queer people within a community?
Yeah, that's also a really good question, because particularly during COVID, like what we found, and I think the world in which we exist, we have to accept that technology and social media platforms have really allowed us to broaden the base of those accessing the archive. And that kind of goes across racial class lines, because the ways in which communities engage in various ways requires some access to technology, right? Having said that, we also have to accept that within this kind of digital world that we live in, access and inequality are still intrinsic to that system, right? I'll give an example. Gala has a youth forum, which is students from Wits University, where we're based, but also from other university and tertiary institutions based in Joburg. And the youth forum used to meet once a week at the Gala offices in our library. And it was really a space for young queer people to speak about what they wanted to. Well, I should say young, majority Black queer individuals, right? And creating those spaces are really important, as a space of affirmation and also as a space of safety. And so COVID happened and we had to shut down our offices, which means that there was this space, this physical space which didn't exist any longer. But we still needed to create a sense of community. And so we decided that it was important to move the youth forum online as a way of still engaging with people during a time where people were then like literally forced back into the closet by having to go home. And we know that universities are such an important space for people to really question their own sexuality and engage in ways that are affirming, right? But we also realized that particularly students who are now pushed back into like rural spaces certainly didn't have access to internet. And so how do we then engage with them? And we had to do it then in ways which did make it accessible. It means providing data to students, like, you know, as a critical lifeline. It also meant, you know, platforms like Zoom were just not feasible. And so we had to like move the youth forum to like WhatsApp, which everyone has, and it's a little bit more easy to kind of engage on WhatsApp. So I think thinking about the ways in which digitization happened, like we have to complexify that question. And I still think it's important for us to do that. It's like, but we have to make those means available. And I think within our space, it also means like, one, like data is a huge issue. Like we can't not think about it. And quite importantly then, even any of our events that we had last year, we had to ensure that there was an opportunity for people to join in ways that, like, you know, if you don't have your own internet or your own laptop or computer or whatever, that you're able to do that. And that's, I think, part of our role is like a community archive. We can't, you know, we can't host events if like the people that we're speaking about aren't able to attend. And so in some ways, I'm also really glad that we've moved back to like physical, you know, activities and engagements, because I think as human beings, that's just important to our like psyche and like, you know, creating the spaces, this community. But I think the digitization has allowed us to really think about ways in which we can extend that platform and also kind of broaden our reach.
The kind of inequality of access to information and to internet plays out a lot in discussions about any kind of access to education, especially when you're living on this online world. And actually, the idea of moving things to WhatsApp is actually such a fascinating way of doing it, because in many ways, WhatsApp itself can be a kind of archive of language and conversation. I'm in too many queer WhatsApp groups that I can possibly count, and there's so much depth and breadth of stories that can come from there, and lots of preservation of knowledge. And in some ways, that kind of speaks to, I think, Charles Morris's theory about queer archiving, how it's queer lives, past and present, are then used to push back against the annihilating silence that you experience within the mainstream media.
Yeah, it's literally like queers out here doing the most for ourselves, you know, realizing that like, if we don't, like, we have to do this, otherwise, you know, it's not going to get done.
Yeah, so speaking more in the nitty-gritty of the digitalization project, what are the kind of selection criteria that you go through for deciding to prioritize what gets digitized?
So that's also an interesting question. And one, I suppose, then it also goes to like Gala strategic objectives, you know? So we are an NPO that's like entirely dependent on like donor funding in order to exist. And so in many senses, that means that we're also like many other queer rights organizations based in South Africa and on the continent, very much subjected to like, where can we get funding from in order to like run projects? And then, you know, our board, because we've gone through some really difficult times where it's like, do we have enough to like keep an archivist, which is essential to like the running of an archive, right? And like projects and all of that. And the Gala board, which is, you know, made up of individuals or academics who are and activists within the kind of queer space, have always been very committed to ensuring that the archives should always remain on the continent and in South Africa. Like that is like a clear objective that, and in that sense, like, you know, it's very easy for like, I don't know, the University of Texas to like, oh, we will take this archive and like, you know, make it part of our, you know, because it's such an attractive, like an amazing opportunity for like, and then the problem really does become of like this imperial sense of like, where does this archive belong? And for us, it's like, it has to belong in the ground here. But then having said that, we know and we knew that there had to be mechanisms by which we consider how to digitize certain parts of the archive, knowing that that's such an expensive project. Like I think archive, like digitizing archives, particularly public archives, is like so expensive. There isn't much support from the state to do that. And so it was really us about us hunting and finding the right partners in which to do that. And then, you know, so with like the Gale archive project, they really were, we were able to kind of work with Gale, who I think have digitized quite a few archives globally. So that was the one thing we knew, that like, at least they had a sense of like why that was important. We also had to be able to direct them to say that like, we will partner with you on this project, but one, we need to be able to make sure that even if this does, you know, some of the digitized archives do sit on some digitized platform, we still have ownership of how we engage, and we need to ensure that our public has access to it for free. And then the other element was that we wanted to know that each and every document which was digitized, we did it in the same sensitivity and care, because it's one thing to have boxes of archived material. It's another thing to have something digitized where, you know, one, it's often then accessible to like, for example, right-wing groups and whatever, who can really, you know, use sensitive information in a queer archive to really make things dangerous for other individuals. And so we went through each and every document which was archived to ensure that redactions were all in place where we felt that that was necessary, and trying to make those judgment calls, particularly when a lot of people are not even alive anymore. You know, how do we like make sure that like dead names aren't referred to, you know, within our context, those things are like really important to us. And Gale, the organization that we worked with to digitize that, were very supportive of us doing that. And so the way in which we then determined which collections made it into the like first round of like digitization was one, seeing which of the collections are the most accessed, kind of looking at data to provide us with that information. Two, it was around like, which are the ones which we feel, you know, if we had to engage with those, we'd be able to make the necessary redactions and still feel that there was an element of safety involved in protecting all of those who had donated or contributed to that, to those collections. And then three, it was, I mean, budget also played a role in that, to say like, how much money did we have and how much time did we have for the first phase of that project? And we had to get in people who really knew what they were doing. Community archives, it's also quite interesting. We also used it as an opportunity to really fine-tune the catalog that we had. Those are some of the things that we were thinking about when we embarked on that digitization project. The other thing is that, like, if I think about the QP collection, for example, we have engaged with the Trans Collective Archive because we felt like that's also so partnerships are also quite important for us, particularly those who really have the skills to do it, but then saying like Kupi should really fit with, you know, the kind of trans archive, because that's really where the kind of like symbolic home is in many senses, you know, together with the like a global community of like, how do we identify trans individuals, and her story in that sense is so compelling that we felt it was necessary. But I think first and foremost is just, I think, ways of ensuring that our archive is never, like no one is ever prohibited from accessing it. Like we have to make sure that like, even if it is, does sit on some like digital platform that accrues some funding for Gala, for example, which the Gale one does, like we get royalties for that, which ensures the like longevity of the archive, right? But at the same time, we can't restrict African scholars, you know, people who walk in and say, hey, I want to look at this. Like, we have to have control over that.
Yeah, the problems faced by infrastructure and restrictions and wanting to push back against imperialistic control of history kind of speaks to the role of journalists and writers and even amateur historians who just run blogs in preserving stories and gaining, making an appointment with Gala, getting access to the archives, even if it means flying to Johannesburg to view it. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on the role that digital media and physical media outside of the space of the archives can play, you know, through storytelling or art in preserving the legacies and stories of queer identity and queer history in Africa.
Sure. Oh, I feel like I might go on a bit of a rant here, so excuse me if I do.
This is what this space is for. It's practically a podcast. Go for it.
Well, and this is why I really appreciate engaging with like queer journalists. And I'll give you like what really frustrates me about journalism, particularly in the engagements with the archive. And we fully appreciate that like journalism in its current stage is like really difficult. Like journalists don't get paid a lot. They're under a lot of pressure. Like the pressure to create content and like sound bites must be like terrible. And so we fully understand the pressures that come with that industry. But what's really frustrating often in our engagements is that journalists would approach us and say, I need queer content. Like, this is my question, and can you give me a soundbite on this? And our response, and then this must also be done within like 2 hours. We're a public archive, so one, we engage with whoever engages with us. Like, that's our role. That's what we're there for. And so we take that very seriously. But we, like, once again, my advice then to journalists is like, you cannot be reporting on gender-based violence and like violence against queer individuals in South Africa, asking me to put you in contact with victims in 2 hours and expect, like, there has to be a sensitivity around that. Like, that feels so extractive. And for us as a community, like, our whole history has been one of extraction. Like, we're not going to be engaging with you on those terms. Like, if you want to do a story on that, like, my first thing is, like, I'm going to, like, sit you down. I want you to come to the archive. I want you to read the catalog and say, this is the environment in which you're operating, which is why that you cannot even begin to approach victims of sexual and, like, physical violence on the basis of their sexuality without understanding.
It's actually against the law as well. It's actually against the law as well. You can't just go and do that.
You can't really, and we would never disclose that, you know? And so then often what happens is like people say to you, oh, we want images and all of those things, which we will readily provide. But then it's also saying, well, that in itself is also an archival project. So what we're helping you, but would you engage with us and say, like, once this is published, or like, where is this going to go? Give us that information, because that also really helps us as an archive. Like, this, you know, this is a relationship which we want to build. And once again, we're not wanting to take editorial decisions. We don't feel that's the role of an archive here. But we are going to advise you on how, like, sensitively engage with a community, you know. And we will remind you of certain things, like, you know, thinking about like the intersectionality between like class, race. And then I often get so disappointed with like journalists when when the relationship is really one which at the end of the day just feels so extractive, once you've gotten your information, you're never going to engage with this community again because your story is out, that we often feel like, no, actually then we should have our own projects, which is what we did during COVID actually, is we engaged with certain academics and said, we're going to publish our own stories about like queer health workers in during COVID, you know, and what that experience was. And at least then that way we have like more control over the narrative, and we can say to the communities that we're engaging with that we have your back. Like, we will never out you. We will never disclose your names. We will, you know, like, ensure that, like, even if you're coming for this interview, for example, that like you have money to get back home, or that like you have a meal, like, you know, all of those things that we can then control. And so it really, like, I think our experience, like, we've become one very wary of like engaging with particularly like very commercial media platforms. And then often we feel like it's so much better engaging with queer journalists because they get it, right? Hopefully. Not always, but I'm saying like they get it, being like, I need to have this conversation with you. And the conversation, which might like, it might not even be, it's the kind of groundwork that like, you know, you're expected to do. So, I mean, part of it is also like, just like, be better, man. Like, just, you know, help us out here. And I suppose that's my rant.
it's something I think about a lot. My queer friend and I, we're both in the writer journalism industry, constantly complain about when we can obviously see there's not a single queer person in the newsroom, or the editorial team is just reporting on a story after it's happened because it's going to give them clicks. Like, most recent one was with Helen Ziller basically tweeting vague transphobia, and then just a bunch of those really commercial clickbaity South African news sites just going, and tweeps responded to Helen Ziller with outrage, and all the people in it were just cis and heterosexual, and it's just, there's no kind of awareness of the queerness in South Africa, and there's no representation for it, and that kind of is the creative technology environment in South Africa. They are these small pockets of queer journalists and queer creators, but for the most part, it is the exploitation of a very particular type of queer identity, and it is usually white, cis, gay male, rather than the flagrant misrepresentations of transness and lesbian women and so forth and so on.
Yeah. And like, just to like, even using this example of the Helen Ziller story, I'm like, none of, like, who cares what Helen Ziller is saying? Like, the fact that we're even giving this person like far more airtime than they deserve, and when like the, like, that's the story that you're focusing on, which is basically just a series of tweets, when we're saying to you that like last year in 2022 there were 26 hate crimes or murders of queer people, and that's not like the story. Like, how can we go back to our community and say, oh, because I can assure you that like activists are not concerned about what Helen Ziller is saying. Like, no one cares, you know, in the broader picture. But once again, it's like, well, who thinks the story is important, right? That particular story.
It's a small,
it's editors, yeah, of yeah. Like, you know, it's just like sitting, who are just completely
so far removed.
Oh God.
I think Gala as an archive also functions really well as this entity to show what the story is, to curate what should be the things people care about. More, it's the lived experiences of people rather than what some white lady said who is past her prime on Twitter.
Yeah. And you know, in that sense, it's actually then quite interesting. I've never like really thought about this, but often that's why it's so difficult for us to get our new, like, our stories into mainstream media. Like, even like, you know, sometimes we think like, I mean, this publication that we did, Outros Corpus Nossos, which is like Mozambican queer history, and like engaging with different, like, you know, news outlets saying like, hey, this is a book you should be reporting on. And there's very little like interest in that. I mean, we still now feel like we have our own like ways of like engaging publicly. And so it doesn't become like a huge issue for us. Like, but often those opportunities are not really taken up, you know, by like mainstream media. And I think that's partly like, that's, you know, the point that you're alluding to is that like, for us, we do feel like we have things to say, and we appreciate or like understand what we feel are like important things to be topics of conversation. You know, we feel like we're on our own when we have those, you know?
Yeah. And I wonder to what extent that's actually the remaining side effect of the social taboo around queerness, that is still very persistent, even in South Africa, which lauds itself as a bastion for queer rights. Yeah, sure, we have it in the constitution, but what, 27 years ago, we had the Immorality Act, and queer people had to fight to get in front of into the constitutional drafting process. And then actually, it circles back to what you're talking about earlier about violent governments elsewhere in Africa. You have Uganda, where you're not gay, is literally, being queer is literally a death sentence. And I wonder if that partially is also the reason why there's limitations for Gala to get the work out. A lot of these journalists, newsrooms might feel like, oh, if we report on this, we're going to anger our reader base, who might not like to hear about these things very much.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. It's like, we don't report on like hate crimes, particularly like, or queer hate crimes. Secondly, also, it's like when women are central to stories, that's also a problem. Like, I think our stories are still, like, nobody wants, really takes much effort in kind of like giving feminist voices, like, you know, airtime. And then I think you're right. Like, for example, when we thought about like Ghana and all of the developments around like, you know, the legislation that the government was using and like people were being imprisoned, how was that not being reported in South Africa? But it really wasn't. And someone's making that editorial choice, right?
Absolutely. Someone is definitely making that editorial choice.
You know, even when we did the Justice for Queer essay campaign last year with other organizations, like I remember how that weighed on all of us within those spaces. You know, like people were just broken by the end of it, and like, you know, attending the vigil, but trying to support families and their victims, and having to report it, and then still holding government accountable. It was all overwhelming, exhausting. It felt so real, and like really just fucking depressing, you know, at the end of the day, because it's like we're doing all of this work and yet it comes out to naught when like people are still being, you know, our people are still being like killed. And then also being like, well, but also the majority of South Africans don't even know about this or don't care, you know. And I mean, that's just such a huge burden on us as like queer individuals within this space to like have to continuously take on. It's a lot.
Actually, focusing directly on that, what do you do as an archival team to unwind and to sort of shed the emotional load of the archiving project? As a team, do you engage in some kind of group catharsis at the end of a week?
Yeah, we really do. We really do. One, we learned, or at least since my tenure, like we learned very early on that like people within our team definitely require psychosocial support, particularly those who are on the face front of engaging with our communities. It is a lot to take on. And then COVID happened, and we were also like, you're all dealing with your own personal stuff, but then there was all this violence, and then we were like trying to do relief work, which, I mean, like, you know, it's not the role of an archive to do relief work, but we also felt like we couldn't turn our back on our community that literally lost jobs, had nowhere to go, you know, all of these things. And so we were like, we're gonna have to help out. And then realizing, one, which I think a lot of people within the kind of civil society sector go through, is like finding mechanisms and being able to support people, but also knowing that there has to be times where we switch off and don't take on this like full responsibility. And then I think once again, you know, going back to this issue of like, the archive is not, it is about creating our own space for our own community and expressing queer joy. So like Utros, the publication that came out and like the launch that we held for that was such an important reminder to us, particularly after like we hadn't had any public events in such a long time. And it reminded us that, like, you know, we also have to be able to express queer joy in ways that, like, hold us. And so, like, you know, even during the Justice for Queer essay campaign, it was really about, like, meeting, like, engaging, you know, like, holding each other in that space. And I will say, I want to say that, like, I think that also explains partly, which I think is a huge issue, and in our upcoming newsletter, we actually speak a lot about this, but I think our community struggles with, like, substance abuse, addiction, mental health issues, because it is a lot to bear. And so we really do have to, where we can, respond to each other with, like, kindness and thoughtfulness. And I mean, I know that all sounds wishy-washy, but honestly, like, if I think about the Gala team, like, on the one hand, like, when we say House of Gala, we really mean that, because we know that we all, like, this work means so much to us. It, like, means a lot to us when, you know, every day, like, coming into the office and showing up. And so being able to show up for each other as well is like, that's quite important.
Definitely. There's definitely such a valuable role in community support. And yes, there's a role to be played with civil activism and, you know, lobbying against the government, but there's also a really important role for grassroots, just engaging with the community, self-care, gently looking after one another, because our lived existence is painful, and it gets played out in these creative it gets played out in the news in sometimes just really horrendous, violent ways, especially if you're paying attention to what's happening overseas in the UK and in the US. And I think actually in some way the deafening silence in Africa about these issues, apart from a couple of, you know, entities, is incredibly traumatic. It's this sort of reminder that we don't actually exist to most people, and realistically, if we kept quiet, who would actually care? If we just disappeared, you know?
Yeah.
Which is a depressing thought, I know.
Super depressing, but also we're not going anywhere. So, like,
exactly.
That's a new boo. You know what I'm saying? Like, I keep, yeah, like, just reminding ourselves of that. And then I will say, what often really gives us hope is, like, engaging with young people. And I don't mean this in, like, a way that's, like, it's just, I suppose maybe also because I now feel like an elder almost, but, like, seeing the Gala Youth Forum or, like, you know, the other day we went to St. Mary's School and, like, we're engaging with young matric learners. And, like, they're like brimming with like confidence, and like they know so much more than, like, I did when I was that age. And you know, asking questions that, like, I was like, wow, like, one of the learners at St. Mary's was, like, asking what the relevance of, like, the pink triangle was, and then we got into this whole conversation around that, and I was like, this is happening in high schools, like, that in itself gives me just hope. And, like, you know, and not to say that that means that everything is, like, resolved, but I think that younger people really, really do get it. And then, you know, people even asking, like, what does it mean to be an ally? Like, how do I engage with bullying online? And part of our response was also, like, one, when it comes to online bullying, the first thing you need to know as a young person is that it's fair for you to protect yourself. Like, you don't have to take abuse, you know, just because it's happening online. So protect yourself, speak out when you can, but, you know, like, also disengage. It's fine to do that. It's like, you know, it's good for your own, like, safety. And that's what we sometimes also have to do when, like, you know, stuff, we just have to disengage, because it's also about protecting ourselves.
I actually want to circle back to the ideas of collection information, because something popped into my head about 2 minutes ago of the idea of the archive being living and breathing and constantly growing. How do you go about preserving history as it's made right now? Is that sort of just looking at what's going on around, or do you facilitate engagement and the gathering of oral history and so forth with members of the community, of the queer community?
We constantly do that. So we're constantly doing interviews and like having those transcribed as a way of like really preserving it. And once again, like, so for us, participating in the Justice for Queer Say campaign was about one, creating a visibility in this like broader movement, but there were also conversations that were happening at the same time as this was going on. And one of the projects that we then did last year was called Relief on the Edge. And that project, which was run by the programs coordinator, Genevieve Lowe, was saying, we know that different organizations are supporting relief work during COVID. However, the experiences of activists on the ground meant that often the ways in which, you know, support was coming from like donor organizations and stuff, there was a bit of a, like a disjoint, like, you know, the expectations of what that is. And so, for example, like, you know, how do we, when there's lockdowns and stuff, like, how do we provide relief packages to people? The easiest and most practical way is like an e-wallet. But being able to do that means we have to really reframe our understandings of like relief, because often it's like, oh, we can't give indigent or poor people money directly because we don't know what they're going to do with it, you know, which is such a patronizing, but really is the way in which like donor organizations working in relief work.
Yeah.
I think it's like, no, if you're not giving a bag of like mealy meal and bread and peanut butter, then we can't really. And we were like, one, it's not safe. Two, like, give people agency. Like, I can't tell somebody whether they should like buy lipstick. If that's what they need in COVID, then like, that's what they need. And that's what we're going to do. We're not going to question that. And because the other thing is that like, we found during that time that like grassroots organizations, like people were remarkably resilient. Like the communities that were created over the time, like there was a Trans Hope organization, which kind of created the shelter for people who were kicked out of their homes. And like, that's the kind of story that we want to know is recorded from like COVID, because it says so much about, you know, queer communities really showing up for each other. It says interesting engagements with like our donor organizations and what activists were doing on the ground. And that for us is really about the living, breathing element of an archive. And that doesn't also necessarily mean not engaging with like historical archives. So like the Queer Hillbrow tour, which we run once a month, which if you're ever in Joburg, you must join it.
A
walking tour that we do, you know, with communities, and it's in partnership with Lala and Jay, which is based at Ponte. And that for us is also about a living, breathing archive, because we're literally walking through the streets of Hillbrow, speaking to what Hillbrow currently is, and then this queer history and how, you know, those two kind of are combined, and then giving people a better sense of what that history is. And I think for us as an archive, particularly when younger people say to us like, oh, I didn't know that. Like, I didn't know that there's Simon Kodi and Babe Ditsy who started the first Pride March in 1990 in October that walked down Pretoria Street in Hillbrow. Like, that for us is, that's, that, then we've done our job, you know? And so I think being able to really do that in both ways, like contemporary and historical, but everything has to happen in the now, is important for us.
Thank you so much for the work you do. I feel like I keep fangirling here, but it just is what it is.
Thank you. I mean, we love the work that we do, so it's good to know that it's appreciated.
You've been listening to a podcast from Container Magazine, an online magazine exploring the humans, processes, and motivations behind creative technology. You can find out more at containermagazine.co.uk. For more information about Gala and the work they do in South Africa, you can visit gala.co.za. Your host, Cassandra Roxburgh, can be found on Twitter at the handle @CassRoxburgh.